But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belfry.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show. I'm Natalia Varsnia and today I'm joined by Rob Starkey, Portfolio Manager at Portfolio Metrics, to talk about the firm's investment views and the evolving MPS sector. Rob, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to the chat.
Absolutely. In a conversation before the podcast, you were mentioning that Portfolio Metrics recently updated its strategic asset allocation and the asset class construction. I noticed that this also aligned with kind of the launch in July of your blended MPS. Can you tell me a bit more about the new strategic asset allocation?
Of course. And we're proud of the blended launch. But taking a step back without blended in the picture, the golden thread that ties everything together for Portfolio Metrics is the strategic asset allocation. So the work that's currently being done is ongoing, but it's important we take our time to get this right, to be precise about it. Because in our world, given our heritage 15 years ago, started essentially in the DFM space, if you want to call it, different words in South Africa. But because investors could essentially customize where they want to sit on a frontier or a risk point, we spend a lot of time making sure that construction is in place properly. Now, what that means for us specifically is our departure point for everything is not a tactical basis. We review our SA on a yearly basis, but we do look long term. We're not ignorant of market trends. So let me give you some examples to bring it to life. At this point in time, we start by having a look at the overall market. Our first sense check is essentially to say, what are the returns that need to be put into this tool to make the current market portfolio make sense? In other words, take the case in point with USA. Our intention is not to deviate drastically from it, but specifically to see what levels of risk we need to assume to make that portfolio make sense. And in our world, it's all about risk allocation. That's the most important aspect. A few specific examples of what we're looking into. We spend a lot of time carving out the granular allocations to different asset classes. So what you're not likely to see in our solutions is a strategic credit manager, for example. We want to control that. And in one niche and very nice asset class is emerging market debt. Now, broadly, people classify this into local, the debt that's issued in whatever emerging currency is issuing it, or hard USD or euros primarily. Most people tend to go for the hard equivalent because it solves some of the complexity with ease of access or hedging foreign exchange. But that's only one quarter of that combined universe. Now, we're assessing whether it makes sense to hedge back the local to hard, because essentially that's what you get. But there's interesting dynamics with risk premiums or additional shape of the curves that we want to bring to the table. All of this work that we're doing at a granular basis guides our allocation to managers, which I'll say, whether it's active or passive, we're agnostic to it.
Mm-hmm. And why are you deciding to do this now?
We do it at roughly this point every year.
Okay.
Essentially, the decision is made roughly at this time, but the body of work is ongoing. We've been working on this for a number of months. So why this given time of year, it coincides to half-year outlooks, it coincides to annual reviews of strategies. But importantly, in our framework, our rebalancing policy is such that we essentially have a trigger rebalancing policy. It means we let our portfolios run. We're not going to tinker with them the whole time. So all the stars align to this point.
I see. It has been a busy year in terms of investment. I mean, Trump's been coming into power. Mm. You've had kind of NVIDIA and DeepSeek shaking the AI technology sector. I've noticed that a lot of kind of DFMs have been becoming a bit more defensive, whether it's going into gold, cash, taking some fixed income allocation. What has been your major investment play this year?
I want to remind you, this might be a bit boring, but we believe at Portfolio Metrics that we don't want to ruin good strategic asset allocation with poor implementation. And generally on my side of the fence now today, it's my job to say we see attractive opportunities in this region and we might be tilting. But we don't tactically tilt in that sense. We do pursue opportunities, but how we obtain them is slightly different. And that's a unique aspect for our business. When it comes to opportunities, one of the areas that we are looking at, because they're present, is potentially the Japan stock market. But this is more structural in nature.
Yeah.
The Japan opportunity is well flagged and publicized. I'm aware that all of our listeners know that. But there's a weird quirk that's more structural in nature that I don't often find being talked about. And that's the world stock indices being calculated based on free float. Now, in Japan, I'm going to mispronounce this, so please forgive me. There's the concept of a keiretsu. And this is essentially the cross-shareholdings of when Japanese companies buy into their value chain. The advantage historically is that it avoids corporate hostile takeovers. The disadvantage is those shares aren't tradable for purchase or sale by market participants. So that's a lower free float, lower Japan weighting. That's completely separate to the Tokyo Stock Exchange reforms. So we're enhancing our relationships with both passive providers and index providers directly to try and get to this.
Okay.
There are some examples, of course, in fixed income or in other structural opportunities as well. I'll quickly mention them, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fixed income, beyond emerging market debt that I mentioned, there is high yield. It's a wonderful asset class. It comes with its own set of risks, but it is a good diversifier. Most investors that you might speak to have a departure point of, let's say, a Bloomberg Global Aggregate Index. That naturally does reduce or eliminate the high yield exposure. So we've spent a lot of time looking into an all-encompassing index, such as multiverse indices, and you're starting to see some products come to the fore in that space. But that's the level that we go to, even though we're strategic investors. The last opportunity right now, and there's many more, but that I'll mention, is structurally, there's a divergence emerging between synthetic and physical. Synthetic examples give you a potential uptick compared to the physical. In emerging markets where shorting prohibitions exist, what you may see is that managers that want to hedge their emerging market portfolios or express their views will pay you a premium for the privilege. It's not just emerging markets. You go to the US, for example, synthetics allow you to overcome the net versus gross return discussion for indices, or even in high yield. There's some synthetic options when it comes to fixed income exposure because the shape of the curves is different, so your structural dynamics offer you different outcomes. So we're not resting on a strategic, lazy approach. We're not laissez-faire.
Okay. And so you were mentioning like Japan of a kind of area of interest. How are you accessing that market?
Our tendered approach for accessing a market all comes down to our manager selection, which is unique in a sense. This ties back to something I want to mention, which we're calling our global alpha study. But the types of managers that we're going to look for aren't necessarily going to take big tactical bets, have one call on a binary macro view. We want that good implementation to come from repeatable sources of alpha. Generally, that's security selection. If you're observing from the outside looking in, what you might see is potentially, in general market terms, a core-like strategy with maybe lower tracking error. It doesn't scale everywhere, such as to smaller caps, that logic. But the general pushback you might have on face value is if the active share is lower or the tracking error is lower, what about passives? So we spend a lot of time to make sure that the expected benefit after costs is positive. And that's where our global alpha study comes into play. I'm calling it that for now. We might have a firmer name later. What the study entails is essentially there's two other prominent studies that happen out there by providers to look at success rates of active managers. But what we see missing for our needs is a long-term holistic data set. And we also want to be able to take that granular approach, but to add fees back on to look at this through a gross returns lens before fees. The reason we do it on this basis is that if the success over our time horizon in our categories is not there for a manager, or it's fleeting and it's not permanent, we're going to make the hurdle a lot higher. Okay. Now, it also helps us when it gets to commercial discussions, because then we know what needs to be divvied up between ourselves for our investors and for the managers. We believe active management is needed. It brings the informational efficiency to markets. I'll give you some key highlights for what we're looking at this point in time.
And just quickly, is this an in-house study that you do?
Completely in-house, working with our data vendors and our providers, consuming billions of data points.
Okay.
It's an extremely large project that we're proud of, and it's an ongoing body of work.
Mm-hmm.
What's surfaced from this body of work so far, counterintuitively, U.S. large caps blend do have a potential for some alpha to be present. Now, most people listening to the podcast would say, maybe not. That sounds a bit too good to be true. Where our nuance comes in is that alpha, or that excess return, is generally not permanent. There's the catch. So whenever we look at a category, we multiply that outcome by our expected chance of catching the manager who can allocate to it. We're also looking at persistency and the manager's ability to capture it. Then we get to a number, we divide that number in two just for this contrived discussion. And in US, you're looking at about 20 to 25 basis points of paying a manager a fee. It's quite a hard hurdle. Some other interesting points that might be worth discussing is mid caps and small caps in US. The number does increase, and it is slightly roughly more than double the number. But you don't see this relationship where you go from mid to small caps with the number monotonically or drastically increasing. Both mid caps and small caps are around a fee level of 50 basis points, assuming a good manager. That's what we assume here. So it is larger in size in terms of the opportunity than large caps, but it's not extreme. And another very surprising metric that came out of our study so far is emerging markets. While it is on a large cap basis, slightly more than double US large caps, 55 basis points to be exact, it's not as extreme as you would think. And there's periods and times where it is fleeting. So this is why this study is important to us, so that we can be granular about where we're going to allocate, because we think for investors' outcomes it is essential in some instances, but only if we pay the right fee.
Okay. And so that study also helps with the strategic asset allocation review that you're doing each year?
It's a follow-on to it.
A follow-on, okay.
Correct. The strategic asset allocation is primarily about our risk, the golden thread, across all our domiciles, jurisdiction solutions, whether it be Ireland, UK, South Africa. This is effectively how we're going to implement. So the good strategic asset allocation, we don't want to ruin it with poor implementation. They dovetail.
Okay, that makes sense. And so you were mentioning that point on the US, and I've noticed there's been a trend of investors moving away from the US because of the concentration risk in the market and also concerns around tariffs. What's been your view on the US? Have you been also moving away and seeking opportunities elsewhere?
Our view on the US is maybe an interesting and boring one at the same time. Our departure point is naturally going to be the All Country World Index for the weight. Now, naturally, that anchors the US starting weight, but we also go a step further. North America includes an allocation to Canada, which in some settings is as large as the UK. Mm-hmm. Now, it's just a market that's generally overlooked. We're trying to factor that in. But it's important to mention again that we're not going to tactically tilt the portfolio. In our solutions in the UK, we are underweight because we have a UK home bias generally. It's trending lower, just like the rest of the market. It is propped up with some of our views and the quirks in the UK market. We can talk about that in a bit if you want. But we've spent a lot of time being conscious about separating our UK North American exposure into large, mid-cap, and small-cap. Now, the body of work is ongoing. But when it comes to the large-cap segment, we're thinking about ways that potentially there might be more repeatability in an outcome compared to a equally weighted index. Because just like if you choose one index provider over another, and I've done the numbers previously, you get very different outcomes. A passive decision is still an active decision, but if you go to an equal weight basis, you're still taking a lot of stock-specific and sector tilt risk. That's not something we necessarily want to be doing in all segments of the market.
Okay. And then I just wanted to shift on kind of ESG investing. At Citywire, we do this monthly study of fund flows based on Morningstar data. And the one in July was actually really interesting because it kind of showed a comeback into ESG and climate-focused funds from investors. Is there going to be an ESG comeback?
Well, I'm sure UK as a whole would love to see that. Looking at the UK stock-specific numbers, unfortunately, we don't see that. I think there's a little bit of performance chasing in a sense, because you've seen a little bit of a reversion or a bounce in performance for some of the sustainability-oriented strategies. I want to mention right up front that the providers of strategies need to make sure that what they're putting out into the marketplace is appropriate. But it's very hard to do that when labels that you apply to your products might be changing. I know certain competitors out there have mentioned that they're looking through the noise and pushing their products out. Whether it's a renaissance of sustainability, I worry that it's some performance chasing, because investors do tend to do this. But hopefully the past few years have weeded out the performance chasing element to note that end outcomes may be in the extreme long run, different path profiles. It's perhaps a little bit too early to tell, especially if most sustainability or ESG strategies are generally high beta. Yeah. So we need to see where the market goes on the whole first.
Yeah, that makes sense. And previously you were mentioning the US, the UK equity market and how you have a home bias. Could you tell me a bit more about that and how you're allocating to the market?
The UK is an interesting one. It captures a lot of airtime naturally. And when you think of the average peer in the UK having maybe roughly 15 to 25 percentage points allocation as a home bias, captures a lot of airtime. Now, we do have a roughly 19, 20 percentage point, depending on the day, home bias in our UK solutions. Our passive solutions that we have, Global Passive, that has no UK home bias, for example. But when we have a look at the UK, the first discussion point that comes to mind is the valuation discount, particularly to the USA. Now, if you have a look at what Europe XUK has been doing for the year-to-date numbers, whether it's a sympathy trade or not, I don't know. But we need to put that discount into context. The assessment that we've gone and done is to have a look at some quality considerations for the UK. I'm going to be specific and mention overall index numbers, because if you're a foreign investor, that's generally where you're going to start, or at least large caps. Looking at the UK compared to US or Europe ex-UK, the return on invested capital, the money relative to the capital spent that you get, is lower. So maybe on that quality adjusted basis, the price is fair. But we didn't just stop there. What about debt? If we have a look at leverage, the overall index is also higher on that basis as well. We need to factor that in mind, especially for foreign investors that don't look through into the market. Now, underneath the hood, we may see that there's sector differences across regions. And that's partly why we say that allocating to different passive solutions is active. So how do you eliminate that? We've gone back over the past 20 years and done a sector-neutralized PE. Just be careful on two fronts. Price to earnings is just a shorthand. And for some sectors as well, there's only a handful of companies. But for what it's worth, it's still indicative. On a sector-neutral basis, the valuation of USA does drop because it overcomes some of the tech bias, and the valuation of UK does increase a bit, but we're not talking game-changing amounts. So it's still a steep discount. What the catalyst is going to be, I'm not sure, but I ran some updated numbers on the UK stock market flows generally for categories. No matter how you slice and dice, it's still negative outflows across the board. So I'm always curious when I see a UK equity fund growing in size. It suggests to me that they're garnering market share from other competitors rather than foreign flows.
Okay, I see. And in terms of risk that could potentially impact your portfolios, what type of risk are you keeping an eye out for?
We track risk through multiple lenses, but right at the start, I mentioned the golden thread of our strategic asset allocation. Because of our heritage going back many years, over 15 years now, we feel as invested as the advisor does in helping the end investor get to their outcomes. So one primary level of risk would be making sure that the investor stays on their journey towards their goals. That responsibility, we believe, should be more widely distributed in the ecosystem. Now, various business models don't allow for it, but ours does, and we like that. The risks that we generally track are across the board, whether it be volatility relative to standardized benchmarks, beta. We go down to every single asset class, what we call sleeve. That means for U.S. equities, corporate fixed income, whatever it is. And we track the relative outcomes to those benchmarks. Our main concern, though, especially if everything that we do is plugged into a financial plan, and we do have a technology stack that's been around since our inception, which integrates into an advisor's daily workflow. If an advisor uses that in that cash flow plan, our main risk is making sure that investors get to their outcome rather than not. So it's a unique lens.
Okay. So moving a bit away from investments and more into the industry, I had a question about benchmarks. There's been some ongoing concern about benchmarks when it comes to data lagging, the lack of ESG comparators, also kind of the big wide bands when it comes to equity risk. What's your view on MPS benchmarks and how are you monitoring performance on your portfolios?
I'm glad you mentioned that. It is a good question and change is happening. It's about time. We've naturally been doing this for many years. I started in this industry actually on the wealth side of the fence 16 years ago. So everything was around even since then, day dot for my career. Now, the opacity has been a large deterrent to advisors because in the new age of consumer duty, you need to make sure that value is delivered for your clients. The good thing about these providers is that it helps the advisors do that. Now, there are a few things I want to mention. Nothing is perfect, and I think what the providers of these benchmarks are doing is great. If you have a look at large data sets, what we often see is that you can't qualitatively review thousands and thousands of lines. It's just not possible. It's a feature of the system, not a bug. And that means you need to skew your analysis towards quantitative numerical methods. Now, these providers, I don't want to speak badly for them. They know this is a problem, and some of them outright state how they're trying to overcome it. But it's not a perfect science. There are providers that move beyond that to assess the qualitative nature of it. But we think that's still got a way to go. Take the likes of yourselves when you chat to providers across the industry. You're providing that qualitative level of insight. But it's not going to serve the purpose of an advisor checking for assessed value against what they need to have a look at. And it's for that reason that we've taken the step to include one of our future coming tech modules, MyCIP, to help advisors do the assessment of value opportunities. Now, another trend that I see emerging is there's highly qualified individuals branching out and setting up their own companies to help advisors address this task, particularly when it comes to panel books of business, which there's some interesting dynamics at play there I'd like to talk about. But once again, we've seen the writing on the wall because what advisors have gone and done is as the industry is consolidated, they've realized that there's single risk with one main large provider. And they've created a panel and in some instances allocated proportionately to certain providers. We've seen this. And we've said, how do we help advisors? Because you don't want to go full circle on the entire process of moving from advisory to discretionary to go back to an advisory panel, especially if you have to do manufacturing responsibilities because it's your decision. Interesting dynamics at play here. But from the benchmark perspective, you hit the nail on the head. If it comes to a certain category, your asset allocation can be quite diverse. A certain risk profile can also be diverse in volatility outcomes. So our multi-manager portfolios, MMP, is essentially underpinned by our technology to say, even within a category, there's diverse outcomes. But this, once again, is a feature, not a bug. Because if you have a look at the overall universe mapping, it forms a place. But advisors would expect that a risk profile 5 is a risk profile 5. That's not the case.
Okay, and so how do you compare? Do you use different comparators? Does it depend on what your clients want to compare you against?
We will go directly to the underlyings and compare. Now, naturally, we have third-party vendors and providers that risk map us. We have a long history of generating our own risk profile questionnaires, or in our language, a financial personality assessment. So we can generate that in-house, and we know how our asset allocation and volatility maps to an outcome. We want to make sure that behaviorally, where an advisor and a client choose on the efficient frontier to sit, that they get that outcome, and that the outcomes are relative from one risk profile to another. There was nothing worse for me many years ago sitting in an annual review and having the lower risk portfolio outperform the higher risk when the market was rising. So for us, that matters a lot. When it comes to third-party risk profilers or mappings, what we often see is that when we're on the edge case in a certain category, especially for our model portfolios, we spend a lot of time discussing with them whether it's forward-looking or backward-looking, because it all comes down to discretion at the end of the day. It's the underlying asset allocation that matters for us.
Okay, that makes sense. And at Citywire, we've reported quite a few times on firms creating new innovative strategies to tap into decumulation as clients move away from the accumulation phase. Does Portfolio Metrics have a strategy to help clients in decumulation, and what does that look like?
I'll not spend too much time on my soapbox here, but we get quite excited. I want to mention right at the start that this was a process that's been in place for advice going back decades. Advisors, wealth managers have always helped clients in retirement. I know there's some nuances in countries where essentially you have state pension benefits, but in my entire investing lifetime, and in actually the decade that preceded me, that's essentially where it was based. And to mention up front, the only way to completely remove risk is to transfer that risk to somebody else via an annuity. I note that where interest rates were low previously, it's not as attractive, but you also pay for the privilege because that risk transfer comes at a price. Now, the way we think about it is investors spend 20, 30, 40, 50 years accumulating their wealth in a certain manner. But then comes the introduction of the Thematic Retirement Income Advice Review, which, by the way, there's mixed views out there in terms of different providers as the route forward. We believe that you don't need to do a complete wholesale change to help investors on the next phase of their journey. What does need to change is essentially the behavioral approach, which indirectly ties to the asset allocation. Mm-hmm. This whole question comes down to why are you doing what you're doing? A large portion of this is due to operational simplicity and explainability. Mm-hmm. But we can go back decades in studies. And one famous one is essentially Modigliani and Miller. A lot of investors may say, I'm going to buy the overall stock market while I grow my wealth, and I'm going to tilt towards dividend-paying income stocks, value-orientated stocks when I retire. Now, the whole reason for that is instead of going into your account monthly, quarterly, yearly, and selling stocks, maybe at a cost, you can get dividends paid to you. That dividend level doesn't generally cover all of your expenses, including advisory, platform, and your income. Mm-hmm. The second thing is back to Modigliani and Miller. One of their studies essentially looked at saying, well, dividends aren't a free lunch. Let me make up a quick, simple example for me. We have a company worth £10. Mm-hmm. It pays a dividend of £1. That's not free. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, the participants in the market will drop the value of the company from £10 to £9. But this is what's often overlooked. So the total return approach is what we favor. Now, in the advisory world, it's quite a popular and common approach to use bucketing. We'll take a proportion of your capital from the growth to the income, you're well aware. But the whole premise of that is to essentially manage what's called sequence of return risk. We know that bad outcomes at the start of your investment when you draw down matter, but while you're growing wealth, it doesn't necessarily matter whether it happens at the start or roughly the end. The math works out. It's quite interesting. But that sequence of return risk, I have some questions. Because if you take monthly income withdrawals from your portfolio, you're spreading the risk of any one of those being at a low point. Now, I know a drawdown can take 6 months or a year. But if I'm going to take 1, 2, 3 years worth of income at one single point, I'm actually concentrating that risk. So I see how if you already have a cash balance once off, it makes sense. But if you don't, I have questions. But it's operationally easier. It's good to explain. It provides absolute certainty. But I think with a total return approach and good technology, with good cash flow planning, you should get most of the way there.
Okay. And so that total return approach, that's the strategy that you have at Portfolio Metrics then?
Correct.
Okay. That's interesting.
It's currently an ongoing discussion point. We don't want to rush into creating product just to garner assets. It's not the way that we work. We work with a select fewer number of advisors. We have deeply integrated and strategic relationships with them. So if we already have cash flow modeling embedded into their process, the advisors and the clients can see dynamically how it comes to the fore. But we are reviewing it. But right now, total return approach makes a lot of sense to us.
Okay, great. I think that's a great point to end it on. You've been listening to The Wealth Show with our guest, Rob Starkey. For any questions, please feel free to email us at wmnews@citywire.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.